So we were gonna
My squadron VB2 was up here. It'd come back up here in November the 15th and 63, and we were here during the earthquake and Hangar 3, and that one day, me and a couple, three other chiefs were celebrating one of them's birthday. We'd taken the day off, you know, and went downtown and taking pictures and drinking beer and stuff, and we went to the B&B bar where it used to be down by the old Russian church, you know, at that time.
Oh.
That area. And we're sitting in there, and they were bartender, like the chickens we had out there and up at the Chiefs Club, you know. They had this big rotisserie, you know, and barbecue chickens. And so he and I went out to the Chiefs Club. That was up on Aviation Hill then, see. It had been a hillside chapel until 57. Then they gave it to the Chiefs to make a Chiefs Club out of it.
Oh, how nice.
So we were sitting in there, he and I, drinking our beer. We had about five in front of us. Everything started coming apart. Geez, it's moving every which way. So we grabbed our beer and went out and sat down on the ground outside. Didn't bother us. We were half plastered, you know. And waited. It was over. And then we jumped in the car and went back to town. Picked up the troops. I borrowed a Harmon Ghia from somebody and brought them back. And they closed the club and made it an evacuation point for defendants. So, gee, well, we didn't like that, so we headed back to town, had a flat, and had to fix that. Went back to B&B bar. We tried to get back to base later, but back down there, well, the city dock was about 6 feet of water from the tidal wave that came in.
So where were you when the tidal wave came?
Well, we were downtown. And I hadn't been paying much attention to it until we started back to the base and seeing all that water there, and we couldn't get in, so we had to spend most of the night up on Cope Street, up above the Westmark, sitting in this car about to freeze. And finally, somewhere around midnight, and we were able to get back to the base. We didn't have any heat, any power, nothing. Boy, that was the coldest night I ever spent in my life. Before, just as the first tidal wave was coming in, see, there was two of them, they moved all of our planes up to the end of the runway, out of water. So they only got water up, partway up through the wheels, see.
So there wasn't really much damage on base, huh?
No, there wasn't a lot of damage. If the tidal wave come in and where Hangar 1 is and washed all the fill and everything out from under the floor and everything, you know.
Where's Hangar 1? Is it the...
Hangar 1 is the one right there by the exchange area, see.
Oh, right there on the peninsula going out to Nyman's? On Nyman's Peninsula? Going out that way? Like there's the exchange and then...
I always get mixed up.
It's right by the runway.
But anyway, yeah.
Oh, the runway, okay.
It's right there, anyway, by the commissary and exchange building.
Okay.
And the first one right there.
I just don't know the hangar number, so I'm trying to put this in my mind.
See, Hangar 3, our hangar, was right there next to the Wolves Mountain. As you go into town, you know, that'd be the first hangar you come to.
Okay, Hangar 3, that's where they have buildings and grounds now?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. And Hangar 2 was in between Hangar 1 and 3.
Right, that's the air station hangar. Hangar 2?
Well, hangar 1 and 2 both are air station hangars.
Okay, I'm getting it now.
Mm-hmm.
So hangar 1...
See, it was built on... Hangar 3 was built on rock, where Hangar 1 was built on fill, see. And when the tidal wave come in, we didn't have that kind of a big dam across there like we have now, see.
Mm-hmm.
And it just washed all that stuff out.
So you guys just had to swing back into action and get that stabilized. Did the Navy have quite a bit to do with getting the town stabilized again, too?
The Navy did, yeah. They brought a carrier in and furnished power until they could get other power brought in.
They just had a generator right on the ship that they just kind of tied into, like, where the KEA or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
I understand you're a family down in Oak Harbor was real distressed because of the radio announcements that they were broadcasting down in the lower 48 about how, what was it that Spencer said that he heard that the Kodiak Island had sunk or something like that?
Yeah, that's what they heard. But see, Red found out, she had a sort of shortwave radio there, and she got a broadcast from Germany telling about the earthquake in Alaska.
No wonder if the information was more accurate there than what they got from the United States radio waves.
I think so, probably.
What about what about the receiver site that's out at Chiniac? Now, was that part of the Navy installation or?
Well, you mean the one on the way to Chiniac?
Well, what's that big the site that's out there at Chiniac?
That was an Air Force tracking station where they used to track. Satellites and stuff, you know.
But that really wasn't tied to the Navy, was it? I mean,
no,
to the war or.
But see, during the Navy, the Navy had that field, that little runway.
Uh huh.
And they had a Navy village up there, mm-hmm. All those old fonts and everything.
Uh huh.
Yeah, that was all Navy.
Now, what did they do? What was the purpose of having the? Was that just like the only accessible runway there, or?
No, that was a kind of a addition, a second field or something.
It seems like it was just so far away, you know, from the main installation. It was.
Mm-hmm. But I guess they used it in World War II there.
So you retired? You retired up here? Out of the Navy?
Yeah. See, I left in '64. Went back to Whidbey Island,
mm-hmm.
And then got transferred to a shipboard type squadron. And then in '65, I went out on the Kitty Hawk.
Now, what's a Kitty Hawk? The Kitty Hawk was famous. I remember hearing about it.
It was a big aircraft carrier.
Uh-huh.
And I spent about 7-8 months on that. See.
Was it involved in warfare, too? Or was that with the Vietnam War? Or?
We were in the Vietnam War, see. We went out in support of that war. I had three those twin jet bombers, and we used them for them. Refueling other planes.
So just as the combat went on, the planes that ran out of fuel would just land on the Kitty Hawk and get fuel gassed up?
Yeah, see, we would go out, and as the planes would take off, we'd have our planes up there, and they would plug in and fill up their tanks.
Oh,
like
they were
the
air in the air refuelers?
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Aerial tankers. And then they'd go on to the mission, and then we'd be out there waiting for them coming back. If they need fuel or something, we'd get more fuel so they get back to ship. Are you reading that book, Spencer, I give you?
I got the story with
you. Boy, it was just like I was out there, that book.
What book is it?
Rules of Engagement that I loaned Spencer to read.
Oh, yeah, I saw he was reading that.
It was about planes flying off our carriers up there. Yep, I was supposed to. See, those planes are over 20 years old at the time we went out there. And these catapult shots on a ship is real hard on a.
The what?
Plane. You know, they are launched by catapult. A big steam catapult, you know. You hook them up. These catapults, and then when everybody's getting ready, they throw the switch and boom, they go off. Right now, 100 miles an hour. See?
I never knew that.
Oh yeah, and then they were so dang. It's real hard on the nose landing gear. And we lost one airplane, not our ship, but another one of our planes, when a cat shot killed a crew.
Oh.
Who went water right in the head of the ship, you know.
Oh.
My nose gear collapsed. So we put them all, the rest of them, in the Cuba Point in the Philippines. That was a Navy air station there. And started working, put a big steel band around the fuselage, you know, around the nose gear and reinforced it. And the first one of ours that was ready to go back, the old man saw, said, "Well, Art, get your gear and let's head back to the ship." I said, "Bullshit, I've been over here 2 weeks and I need some liberty. Working day and night over there, you know." "Well, okay, you catch the next one." There's another guy who wanted to go back. He'd been over there shopping, you know, and they never got there.
Oh my gosh.
They got shot down, right? They got too close to Hainan Island, which was China.
Mm-hmm.
And the Chinese come out and shot them down.
Boy, that's three times that just in this conversation that fate has saved you.
Well,
that's three major saves. That's incredible.
Well, just like on the Yorktown there in Battle Midway, after losing all my people in a Coral Sea battle like that, on this time I had them scatter out on the port side of the hangar deck so that maybe one would get hit, but not everybody. And I was laid down behind a big aerial torpedo that was tied down to the deck, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And a bomb hit the flight deck right above us and over a little ways. And just blasted everything, see? And that old torpedo was just mangled by shrapnel.
Jeez. But did it explode?
No. No, it was not.
Armed?
Active. Armed. But one of my feet was sticking out the end of it, and I got one piece of shrapnel in the heel. And one of my other troops was laying down, you know, and his hand was right by where my feet was, and he got a hit on the hand. Otherwise, we would have been hamburger, I would have been.
Oh.
But then one time out of the Vietnam War, we were flying back in the Philippines, going up there, and the dang North Chinese or somebody was after us. And my job was to keep triggering this instrument right where I was sitting. And it deflected a radar, and we could see the rockets going by us. But we never got hit. Well, we flew in the Philippines there and went up the BOQ and pooled over money, and we bought all the beer they had there in the machines and sat out there and drank it all. Next morning we had hangovers, but we were alive.
Oh, God, that's incredible. That's incredible.
No, those are wicked days. Those wars.
Yeah, and it seems like there was a lot of wars right then. I mean, it just seems like they one ended and the next one picked up.
Yeah.
No, it just seems like it's just like a cycle. It's surprising that our wars now, we have so much technology and they're smaller. They stay smaller. They seem like they're smaller. You know, they don't involve as many, or maybe they do involve as many people, and we're just not as personally touched by it.
Well, I think we should stay out of these NM conflicts. See? Like, now we shouldn't have gone over to,
Are you talking about Desert Storm?
Huh?
Desert Storm?
No, I'm not talking about that one, but Somalia.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
We didn't have any business going over there because we didn't do any good, maybe a little while, but finally, we didn't, because we didn't really try, you know, we just had people over there, and first thing you know, they turned against us or anything. And then down here in Haiti,
uh-huh.
Well, that's another place we're not going to win, see.
Yeah.
And then now over in the Middle East, we should just, the United Nations ought to stay right out of there and let them kill each other off. Because they're never going to settle down, see, they
have
too much hate.
Yeah, possibly. So I was going to ask, how did your tour of duty finish up? Where did you retired in Kodiak?
Yeah, you see, I come up, and after I come back from Vietnam on the Kodiak, I got transferred to Kodiak.
You requested that?
Mm-hmm. And I got him up there in 66. Spencer and I drove up to Alcan. And well, Spencer had to live in the barracks for quite a while. And the Red come up, and we all moved into the Roach Haven over there. Old building on the base where people were, families were living a short time until they could get a house. And the Roach was running every place. Then Nemeth Park opened up, and we had to haul our own furniture and everything down to it.
Well, they didn't have housing to carry all your furniture around for you and move you back and forth and pack you in and pack you out.
I think it was a mess.
Was Nemeth housing brand new then?
Yeah, it was brand new. When we went in there, we were the first families to go in there, see.
So it was pretty. It was pretty luxurious.
Oh, we thought it was brand new. Yeah, we on the. The furnace that heated the whole building, which was a sixplex, mm-hmm. was right under our apartment. And when it would turn on and go whoop, and the rugs would lift up off the floors and everything. Oh, what a mess. But we made it.
So when you got your time off, when you weren't on duty, what did you do for entertainment here?
Oh, we'd go to the club usually. Sometimes we'd go downtown and hit some of the bars. There was a lot of good bars when I first came up here a long time ago. Like, there was a place called the Montmartre's, which later became the Harvester. Remember the Harvester?
Yep, I remember the Montmartre even.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was here when the Montmartre was here.
And they even had topless dancers and everything then.
Yep.
Then Tony's, before the earthquake, was a nice big place. And the Mecca, let's see, Tony's and the Mecca and a whole bunch of those other places were demolished during the earthquake. There was a place called The Village was here then, and it was up higher, about on the same level the Ford garage used to be.
Oh, so it was up the hill a little bit.
Someday I'll show you some slides of how it used to look.
I would love to see your pictures. I would love to.
I got a bunch of slides back there someplace. And of course, you go up in the Westmark in the hallway there, and you see a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, but it's not the same.
But it was a nice town before the earthquake. I don't think it's ever been the same since.
No, Kodiak has been a town that seems to have changed drastically with time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially if there's any break in duty or service, so to speak. Because every time I left and came back, I noticed it was a little different. And now it's a lot different.
The Beachcombers was a nice place to go way back before the earthquake. That was out there, and then when it washed away and the tidal wave, where later they brought an old ship in, you know. You don't remember the ship, do you?
Yeah, I remember the ship, but I don't remember the place before that.
Well, Roy, you didn't get there before that. You didn't come before the earthquake.
No, I never did.
Okay. So then they finally took the old ship out and built the new Beachcombers, and neither the ship or the New Beachcombers was ever a real nice place to go to see.
No.
And then they built all the others like Tony's and the Mecca. And the Village Bar, that's all new stuff. Right after the earthquake, they put up plywood palaces. And everybody went there too.
You know, I wanted to ask you about Mother Goose because I've heard your Mother Goose stories, but I never really knew how the Mother Goose camp started and what the significance
of
it was.
Back in 69, before I retired, like Captain Acker and much of them, Commander Bernhardt, they decided that we'd been over there hunting before that sea and stayed in an old log house that didn't have had a wood floor, didn't have a door, all that. Then we camped there.
Well, where is it exactly?
Well, I'd have to show you on the map. It's too difficult to tell you.
But I mean, is it like on the mainland or?
It's over on the Alaska Peninsula.
It's on the Alaska Peninsula. Is it like across from Kodiak?
Well, you go from here down towards Wide Bay, then you cross Lake Maturoff and another lake and get through Mother Goose Lake. something.
Oh, so it's a lake. Okay, that's, I didn't know that.
See, Mother Goose Lake is about 7 miles long, mm-hmm. about 3 miles wide in spots. So they asked me to build a cabin, prefab it in a hangar. And Spencer helped me a lot on that. So we mocked it all up and everything and got it all set, and then we took it down and flew it over there on a HU-16, which is an amphibious plane, you know. I built a boat, 16-foot long boat, 4 feet wide, in two sections that bolted together in the center, and had styrofoam, a lot of styrofoam for flotation. You know, it was a pretty good boat. And then there was this one guy, went over there with his son and a Chief Coastie, and they took it out one day, and they didn't take the oars, they didn't take any life preservers. They just had the motor seat. Big storm come up, and the engine quit, and it started rolling. And the dad had his hip boots on, he wouldn't take them off. Finally, he was trying to hang on the boat. He just finally gave up and sank.
Oh.
And the other two guys never finally was able to get to the beach and walk around, you know, and get back to the cabin. And some people try to blame that on the way I built the boat.
Oh, no.
But it was actually a good boat if you treat it right, you know.
Yeah, have a brain.
Take your life preservers and oars so you could keep it in the wind or whatever if your engine quit. But after that, I built outriggers.
Oh, outriggers like the Hawaiian boats, kind of?
One on each side.
Uh-huh.
And they were 8 feet long, and I put them more square, filled with styrofoam, and on big pipes, and they were a foot out from each side of the boat. And they worked real good. It was an 8 foot wide boat then, see?
Uh-huh.
Made it real stable.
So you guys would go across the lake and shoot a moose, and then...
And you could go all the way down the river, across the lake, or anything, see? But then, one time, I was over there, and across the lake, and I was up in the woods, and I found this John boat. Aluminum John boat. With 35 axe holes in it. Somebody, the guy that had owned it, he lost his camp, so he drug his boat up in there, and he took an axe and went from one end to the other. Big holes this wide, where he'd take an axe and just chopped it all up. So we brought it back here, and I wanted to, this was after I retired, wanted to get it fixed in the hangar, you know, and then I, the lieutenant in charge there, he wouldn't let us. So, took it back over there, and old Marvin Black and I spent all day one time putting patches on it. Got it all patched up, and I took the outriggers from the old one and put it on that one, and it was a nice day. So I got all kinds of pictures that shows how this thing looks. Now they sold a boat and tore a cabin down, and so we don't have any more camp. So we have to use a tent. And this time, old Captain Acker and all these guys were over there, and it rained every night and blew and stormed, and they were wet all the time.
Not a fun way to camp.
No.
Not a fun way to hunt.
Not fun at all.
So who found Mother Goose? I mean, who figured out it was there? Was it like a Navy tradition, or?
Oh, I don't know. A couple, 3 years before I went over there in 69.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. But a year or so before that, they used to fly over there and camp.
Did the military planes fly them over there, or did they rent a commercial plane
there? First, we used our Navy plane to fly them over there, see. But when I went over in 69, one of these little outfits around here took us over there. Then eventually after that, we used Kodiak Airways and the Grumman Goose, you know, to take us over there.
Yeah, Hal Derrick used to fly you guys over there?
Yeah, he had his own plane later. And then we used to use him to fly us over. He was reckless, though.
Yeah, he liked to fly on the edge.
And he finally killed himself that way.
died too.
Yeah, well, Harold was a good guy and everything, but he took too many chances. Now we like this guy, I can't think of his name, huh?
Patterson.
Patterson. He used to fly for Seahawk, but he used to fly at the same time. He was with Patterson in that outfit, you know, but I can't think of his name.
So when you retired from the military, you decided that you wanted to retire and stay in Kodiak.
Well, at that time I couldn't stay more than 30 years, and I had to get out of 30, so I retired back in 70, and Red and I camped out in that little trailer up there above the Buskin for quite a while, and then decided we'd take a trip back to Missouri, so parked the trailer on the base and loaded up that old truck that you guys finally got from me, and Red and I grabbed a case of beer and put a bunch of clothes and some pillowcases and caught the ferry and headed south. We had a real good trip down to Alcan. Had the cat and the dog. Camped every night. All the way to Missouri and back, and back up here. Then we went to Sulphur Cove and spent the winter.
Oh yeah, that's right. You did the lodge over there, huh?
Mm-hmm. That was a cold place. One night, had a small space heater, a lot smaller than that one out there, and then come a big storm, and it started shaking and going on, and the firebox fell out on the floor and started a fire. Another time, while I come in to do the laundry and get some more brandy and coffee, there was another big storm, and all the stove pipes on above the roof went out in the woods.
Oh no.
Mm-hmm.
Red stayed out there by herself while you were in town?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, what a pioneer woman.
And the ice would freeze in the water right in the kitchen overnight. We'd go out, and I'd have to go out in the lake to get water and cut a hole in the ice, you know. And one time it snowed, and the old dog, special old dog, it fell in the water, and I had to pull him out by the ears. And I thought that was real funny. There, so later I went out there, and it snowed, and I fell in.
Oh, you didn't see the hole? You stepped right in the hole?
No, I didn't see the hole. I didn't think that was so funny.
Nobody had to pull you out by the ears, though.
No, I was able to get out. And I had another old dog they called Charlie. He was out there one morning early with a bark and like everything right outside the door, and I thought there must be a bear out there. I opened the door, cracked and peered out, and there's old Charlie up next to the door, barking, and right in front of him, chewing on old deer carcass with a big old red fox.
Oh my.
That old Charlie had drug up there, I guess. And I said, God damn it, Charlie, here, chase him off. And he made a big jump at that fox, and the old fox went out across the lake like that, you know, and old Charlie thought he was proud of himself. He come back, you know, tail wagging everything, and sit back on the porch and turn around, and there was that old fox chewing on the thing again. And followed him all the way back, see? That's the God damn it, Charlie, chase him away. And this time he did, and the fox didn't come back. We had a good winter, though. But when, after that stove happening, I came in, and Marv Black gave me a nice big space heater like I bought in the Tubbs, and I took out there and put it up. Then we had a fireplace, too, but all the heat would go up the chimney. So I come to the base, they gave me a big chunk of stainless steel, and I put it in the back as a reflector, and it reflected the heat back out in the room, worked out real good.
And then you guys did the VFW for a while too, didn't you?
Yeah, after that. Why, I needed somebody to run the VFW. And so we went out there because we didn't have any place to live. So about 2 years there, so.
2 years?
Almost 2 years.
Wow.
Then, Dorothy Spencer owned that house right there by Island Plumbing. It used to be a purple house across the street. So she rented it to us. We lived there for quite a while until moved out here again.
So how did this land out here come up for sale?
Well, while I was running BFW, they had the first land auction, the borough did. And Captain Acker and I come out here and we walk all over this area, you know, and trying to pick up what we wanted. And I liked where Donahue lived, but they bid that up so high we didn't have any money. And went through several of them I bid on. And finally, I bid on this one. I kept waiting for some bastard to bid against me. Nobody did, so I got 4.5 acres for $2,700.
What a steal. We think that was a very good investment.
And Red seen the acre I wanted, and oh, she cried when she seen this.
Oh, she did?
Oh, she thought that was the most sad-looking place.
Oh, she's probably thinking of all those nails she was going to have to pull.
Then we get Spencer and Robin, or you guys, that acre, and then there's old Mac Withy wanted an acre. So we sold him one for $1,000, and then this other friend wanted one, so we sold him one for $1,500. And he turned around and sold his for $18,000 and left the East Coast.
I know, is that incredible? Mm-hmm. That was Evans's.
Right.
Yeah.
But it was still a good bargain.
It was an excellent bargain.
And then when they had the other land auction, well, that was over across the river, so. Mm-hmm. Everything went up to 30,000 at least, I think. Mm-hmm.
But this is the best side of the river because you get all the sun.
Yeah, we like this side.
It's really nice. Now you have this nice little Quonset hut that you've made for, you scavenged and put together, and you're set.
Yep, I think it's comfortable. It doesn't look, it wouldn't look good on Reznov.
No, but it looks just right here. How long is it again? How long did you say this was?
100 feet.
100 foot long, gosh.
I took a picture one time from that end, looking this way with that dang fish eye lens.
Uh-huh.
And it looked just like a runway on an airport.
Well, for a long, long time when Bell's Flats was settled, wasn't there just basically military people out here on this side?
Yeah, it was all Army at that time, see, right here.
Uh-huh. But I remember when Cassidy's were out here, and Greer's, and York's, and you guys, and Getty's, and Williams, and those guys, you guys were all retired, or Navy. Weren't you guys all Navy people?
Yeah, we were all Navy, because we didn't have any Army left out here, see.
Uh-huh.
Now, we were the first ones lived up here at Red Knight. And then, seemed like I was going to be the mayor, and there's old Fred Greer who did, he had all the guns and everything, and no, he was going to be the dog catcher because he had the beagles. And
oh, that's right.
Roddy York had the guns, and he was going to be the chief of police.
Oh, that's scary.
And, I forget.
How about Bud Cassidy? What was he going to do? Do you remember?
I think he moved in a little later after we got everything squared away.
It was quite a while before they had power and telephones out here. How long before you had power?
Well, we lived out here quite a while, and I bought that dang generator down here. We hadn't used it for not even a month, and they brought power out. But even then, we used to have a lot of outages, and I had to start a generator up. So.
And then the phones, before they had phones,
no,
everybody used those
CBs. CB radios. Red was Cherokee Red, and I was Martini Art. Bob Hatcher was Rapid Robert. And everybody would listen in on the party lines every day.
Yep, that was the hot time of the day, was to listen to the CBs when people were coming home from work and in the evening.
Oh, Mrs. Cassidy was the nosiest old lady.
Yeah. No, yeah, Gatorade, that was Loretta Harris out of Timmy. Yeah.
Yep, we didn't mind. If we want to make a long distance call, we'd go down to the KI or somewhere and make a telephone call.
Good excuse to go to town.
Yeah.
Now you got all the modern conveniences.
Yeah. Still have to go to town.
Yeah, still do. Well, I sure appreciate you doing this interview with me, Art. I think you got a little bit of local history and got my paper done and got a good dinner, too.
What are you going to do after you type that now?
I'm going to type it. I'll give you a copy.
You have to have him sign the release.
Yeah, I'll have him sign the release, too. I swear I'll have him sign the release, Dr. Stevens.